even though the women came from such different backgrounds, they were all told the same thing, which was that they couldn't play football, and they both had the same desire, which was to play football. And so for as different as they were when they were on a team together and on the field, they had the shared experience of kind of being up against the world together. And it really bonded women that may not have had opportunities to meet each other otherwise.
This is Unladylike. I'm Kristen. And with all due respect, step aside, Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. This episode on Ladies, we're in for a football story that even today's guest did not see coming.
My name is Frankie Della Creta, and I am an independent journalist whose work focuses on the intersection of sports and gender. And I'm the co-author of a book called Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League.
The National Women's Football League was the first and only pro women's football league in U.S. history. It kicked off in 1974 with seven original teams: the Toledo Troopers, the Los Angeles Dandelions, Columbus Pacesetters, Dallas Bluebonnets, Fort Worth Shamrocks, Detroit Demons, formerly the Petticoats, and finally, the California Mustangs. The league lasted until 1988, with teams coming and going in at least 19 cities across the U.S. Hundreds of women padded up and hit the field during its 14-year lifespan. And yet, our guest Frankie, who is a sports reporter, who grew up watching football with their mom and was on the cheerleading squad in high school, like no stranger to football, Frankie only discovered the league's existence kind of by happenstance. And even then, there was so little information about how it came to be and who these players were that Frankie and their Hail Mary co-author, Lindsay D'Arcangelo, realized that this was a story that needed telling.
I think this story is one of those like once in a career kind of opportunities. Like, how often do you come across a historic sports league that has never really been documented before? You just kind of don't, not on this scale anyway. And it felt really exciting. It kind of felt like football's version of a league of their own.
But if y'all think women playing baseball was a spectacle back in the day, just imagine the reactions to women and girls playing football.
What's going on, Linda? Come on. Nice looking person like you in a football uniform.
Well, I just like to play. It's something I want to do. And when I was little, I just like to do anything. And football is anything.
Yeah. let's see, you're a running back.
In 1939, Life magazine reported on the first full-contact girls' football game with the headline, "Purse-toting footballers draw stares." Yeah, really taking it seriously. American football was invented in the 1880s, and the first known women's game took place on the evening of November 21st, 1898. It was a 5-on-5 scrimmage, Yale versus Princeton. Yes, it was a bit. It was basically the pregame entertainment before a men's social club ball. And the way it went down, this game, the scrimmage, actually set the tone for what the National Women's Football League would go up against nearly 75 years later.
It was a warm summer evening, and all but a few of the Dallas-Fort Worth Shamrocks football team members had shown up for practice. The team isn't backed by a lot of money. The coaches do their work for free. As sponsor Joe Matthews put it, "I just decided to put money into the Shamrocks instead of buy a new car."
Football history, kind of just like any other sport, has women in it from the beginning, even if we don't hear about them, and even if there were a lot of barriers to their abilities to play. So women, you know, have been trying to play football since the game's inception. And that first instance that you mention, it's a gimmick. It's meant for entertainment of men. You know, it's women playing in like little outfits while men watch. It ends up getting like broken up by the police because they were worried that the women were going to hurt themselves. And right there, that kind of encapsulates everything you need to know about the history of women's football, which is that it often was framed as a gimmick or as less serious than when men played. And it was something that was often billed as a spectacle or for male entertainment. And then you have that other piece where they're worried that women are going to hurt themselves. Part of the reason that women were prevented from playing football and, you know, many other sports is this paternalistic fear that women can't be trusted to make decisions for themselves and that their bodies and their reproductive value needs to be protected at all costs. There was this fear that their uterus could fall out, they could get breast cancer if they were hit on the breast, but they do play. You will see games being organized at high schools. In the 30s, there were games that were being covered, you know, by Time magazine. But the same thing seems to happen, which as soon as they get any sort of attention, they get shut down pretty quickly for fear that it's not safe.
So given all of those factors, all of those fears, how did the National Women's Football League even happen?
The National Women's Football League, which officially started in 1974, the seeds of that are planted in the late 60s with a man named Sid Friedman. We liken him to like P.T. Barnum in our book. He was a promoter who really was not above a gimmick and really wanting to follow the money. And so even this league that ended up being a pro league started because a man wanted to put women on the football field as entertainment and as this sort of spectacle. He envisioned like sort of a Harlem Globetrotters with like ripaway skirts and like women's teams that were like barnstorming the country playing men's teams. That really was his vision for this league. But again, as we see in history, women, he was surprised. He put out these ads and like women showed up and were like, you want us to play football, right? Like we're ready to play football. And it is the players and the women who really made it a real viable thing.
Yeah, it does seem like this constant with the ripaway skirts of it all, of this, I don't know, just bizarre mashup of sexual objectification and hyper-masculinized violence. It was sort of like that was the gimmick.
Yeah. I mean, he sent photographers from Hustler magazine, like out to their practices to try to get pictures. And I think this hypersexualization is something that, again, something that women have really grappled with throughout the history of trying to play sports. And the belief has always been that A, women don't watch sports and like women aren't the audience that you need to attract in order to have a successful league. And in order to be successful, you need to attract men. And because women are supposedly not as good, the only way that men are going to want to watch them play is if they think those women are hot. And so speaking of a league of their own, if you look at the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, they played in skirts, right? They did that because they wanted men to watch the game, and they also didn't want the women to be viewed as lesbians, which many of them were, as they were in this league.
How would you kind of describe this group of players? Can you sort of paint us a picture of where they were coming from, their backgrounds, all of that?
This league was incredibly diverse. It was racially diverse. There was a ton of class diversity. There was a lot of diversity around sexual orientation. And you had really had players from lots of different backgrounds. You have professional women who are working in managerial roles. You have stay-at-home moms. You have hairdressers. You have women who are climbing telephone poles with the cable company and mechanics and kind of everything under the sun.
Maybe this seems like an obvious question, but why did they want to play football?
I think they wanted to play football for the same reason, you know, that boys want to play football. And I think when we're talking about football, let's talk about where these teams were. There's several teams in Ohio. Ohio is kind of the birthplace of football. The Football Hall of Fame is there. You also have teams in Detroit and Oklahoma and Texas and a few out west in California, but they were really kind of centered up the middle of the country. And so these women are growing up watching the world around them be obsessed with this sport, right? Whether their brothers are playing, their fathers are watching, and they're being denied the opportunity to participate. One player who told me that she joined the marching band because it was the closest she could get to the football field. We had more than one cheerleader. They just loved the game and they wanted to play. Many of them grew up playing pickup games with the neighborhood boys and with their brothers. Many of them were really high performing athletes in other sports. And so that it was natural that football would be something that they wanted to play. And I think this is actually a really important thing that we are talking about, because one of the reasons that women are often believed to not be as good at sports as men is not because there's a talent or a skill differential or deficit. It's that they haven't had access. They haven't had access to programming or training or equipment that fits their bodies or any of these things. And so people come out to watch and they're like, you said this was professional. The NFL would blow these women out of the water. Well, of course they would. These women just learned how to play last year.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about what the actual play was like and how it was different from, say, like powder puff football.
I mean, this is real full contact tackle football, and they played mostly by NFL rules. And again, many of these women were athletes. You have the quarterback for the Oklahoma Dolls. Her name was Jan Hines. She was part of Oklahoma's first softball team under Title IX. You have Linda Jefferson, who many regard as one of the greatest halfbacks ever, like in any either league. She's incredible, but she was a track star, very, very fast. And I will say what's really interesting in reading the coverage of this league is many of them are coached by men. And the sexism that like drips from these men is really quite incredible. Even the ones that wanted to be there and believed in the women, I think really doubted the women's abilities. And you hear over and over again how surprised these male coaches are at how teachable they are, how quickly they improve, how tough they are, how dedicated they are. And you can kind of watch over the course of like a season or a couple of years, the same coach, the way he talks about his players really changes as he grows to respect them and to see that they're real serious athletes who really are. It doesn't surprise me. They were so desperate for this information and for someone to actually like teach them the fundamentals of the sport. It's like they're drinking it up after a drought. They're like relieved to finally be getting the kind of coaching that the boys had always gotten.
So how did recruitment work?
Recruitment happened through ads in the local newspapers, radio spots, and word of mouth. You see that a lot of the women, there's usually groups of them who have some familiarity with each other because they've played other sports together. The Dallas Bluebonnets team had a really, really large contingent of local lesbians on it. I mean, all the teams had lesbians on them, and we can talk about that more. But, you know, Dallas in particular, I think, is a good example. A lot of the women found out about the tryouts because they all were hanging out at the local lesbian bars together. And a lot of those women's bars had sports leagues that were organized through them. And so they found out about the football team that way and kind of all, you know, came to the tryouts together. But it was mostly, yeah, like word of mouth and newspaper ads trying to recruit people.
Yeah, I did love learning about this. You know, it's like, it's not the kind of Dallas football story that you might typically think of.
Yeah, I did not expect to end up going down a rabbit hole of the history of lesbian bars in Dallas, Texas when I set out to write this book, but I was so glad I got to. And Lindsay and I are both queer, and it was so important for us not to heterosexualize the league, the players, the book. We really have to grapple with both the reality that many women who play sports are going to be stereotyped as lesbians just because they play sports, with the fact that many women who play sports are lesbians. And it was really important to us that this was a queer history book, as much as it was a women's history book, as much as it was a sports history book, because I think writing queer people back into kind of any and all history is really, really important. And especially in women's sports, to show that they've always been here. And I did not know whether these women would talk to me about the fact that they were gay. I had done some reporting on the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and that league, you know, was during World War II in the 40s and 50s, and I had been trying to identify queer players in that league. Most of the women that were still alive would not talk about it. And because I'd had that experience, I like wasn't quite sure if any of the women were going to want to talk to me about being gay. And my like second phone call, I was 2 minutes into it, and one of the women, her name is D.A. Starkey. She's a character. She's amazing. She stops me, and she's like, you know we're all gay, right? And I was like, oh, thank God. Let's talk about it. And we did. But it is, like, again, let's put this in historical context. We're talking the early 70s. We're talking post-Stonewall, right? And I think that there is this idea when we talk about queer history in the 70s, like, yes, there is, like, a burgeoning, like, queer liberation movement, and the first pride parade in Dallas was in 1972, which is the year that the Bluebonnets formed. So we can look at the culture around and see that this thing is happening. But, you know, Dallas in 1972 looked a lot different than New York City did in 1972 or LA did in 1972. And I think that there is this narrative when we talk about queer history, like, that queers in rural places or middle America or red states are getting on buses and heading for the coasts and like heading for blue states. And that's where they stay. They live and they stay. But there are these thriving queer communities in red states, in rural places, in the South, in middle America, who that's their home and they're not going anywhere. And they're still there and they've been there. And it was so important for us to highlight that, because I think that that reality really gets erased when we talk about queer history. And there were straight women on these teams. I'd say, depending on the team and depending on what region they were in, I'd say anywhere from like 50 to 70% of the teams were gays are the numbers that we got from players. And even for those women, I will say that many of them told us that being on those teams and in community with gay women at that time in their life, like, forever shaped their social politics.
What significance is the timing of Title IX to all of this?
Title IX both like does and doesn't affect this league. It affects the league a little bit because some of the players that we see on some of these teams were like part of some of the first sports teams under Title IX at their universities. But most of these women either didn't go to college or were beyond college age by the time Title IX was passed. And Title IX is legislation, you know, that impacts schools. And so this being a pro league wouldn't have been directly impacted by Title IX. But Title IX is in the newspapers. Women's sports is on the upswing, and there is a cultural conversation that's happening. Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs' Battle of the Sexes was in 1973. And so you really have this increased awareness of women playing sports that is kind of like happening around this league and in the culture at the time, even if Title IX itself wouldn't have had any direct bearing on the league.
Well, you know, speaking of Billie Jean King, Battle of the Sexes, Title IX, what about the feminist movement that's also taking place at this time?
I think one of the most interesting things to me when I was reporting this is the relationship of the players who played in this league to second wave feminism and the women's liberation movement. And when I first started researching this league, I saw that a lot of stuff that had been written about it really positioned it as part of this, you know, the women's liberation movement, or like happening alongside of it. And I think it did happen alongside it, but I found when I started to ask the players about their relationship to women's lib, many of them sort of knew it was happening. Many of them did not. And most of them did not identify, at least at the time, as feminists. They weren't playing football to make a statement about feminism. The women's lib movement at that time also was really focused on issues of, like, you know, domestic labor and childcare and things like that, which didn't affect a large majority of these women. And because so many of these women were working class, they honestly were so concerned with the day-to-day of their lives that they did not see themselves reflected in that movement. And also many of them were Black women who didn't see themselves reflected in that movement. And so I think it's really easy when you're taking a long lens view of this kind of thing to be like, oh, well, this league was happening at the same time as, you know, second wave feminism and this particular like women's movement. And it's really easy to flatten it and to say, therefore, these women must have been part of that. And I think out of respect for who those women really were and are, it's really important to make the distinction between the two and say that, yes, while some of those women may have identified with that then or do identify with that now, at the time, playing football wasn't necessarily like a big feminist statement. They literally just wanted to play football.
When did the National Women's Football League kind of peak, and how big was it at that point?
So the league officially started in 1974, and we mentioned Sid Friedman earlier, who really wanted them to be in Hustler magazine and wear tearaway skirts. The women broke away from him to create a serious league, and that happened in 1974. I would say that the league reached its peak in like 1976, 77, 78. Those were the biggest years where you had as many as 12 teams. The Columbus Pace Setters out of Columbus, Ohio is the only team that lasted from the very beginning to the very end of the league from 74 to 88. They ended up forming a corporation and bought themselves from the men that owned them. I love them. They're amazing.
And were players paid?
In theory, the players made, and this is what makes them a professional league, right? Is that they got paid. The players made about $25 a game at the beginning. And then very quickly, the teams and the owners ran out of money and they stopped being paid. And so many of the players never saw a dime.
And yet they played anyway.
They did. They worked full-time jobs and were training many days a week, and they did it all for nothing. And in fact, it usually cost them money. And this, again, is actually the current state of women's football, is that many of the women are paying. And I think it's a testament to how badly they want to do it.
We've talked about this a little bit, but describe to me how women's football was portrayed in the media and how they were talked about.
The media coverage is so appalling. We've talked about the idea that women's football is seen as a gimmick, and you see that in the media coverage, right? Like, people want to come gawk, and they cannot believe that women are playing football. And the coverage really mocks these women. It says really horrible things about their play, but for the most part, it doesn't talk about the play at all. It focuses on the women and their appearance, and really also pits a lot of the women against each other when it comes to how they look. Players who were conventionally attractive received the most press attention. They were, you know, photographed much more frequently. And often the players who were more feminine, like, their appearance was used to mock their teammates who were less feminine or who were bigger women. Because again, we're talking about football. You have real body diversity on these teams and can be a very, like, fat positive space in a world that, like, does not have a lot of those. Also, like, your gender is not policed, you know, on the football field in that way. And so there are just a lot of big masculine women, and those women were really torn down by the media coverage. The players were asked how their husbands and, like, boyfriends felt about them playing. That was, like, everyone's favorite question. And I think what's really important when we think about the media coverage is that the league is being written about through the lens of the people who are covering it. And at the time, those are mostly sports writers and they're mostly men. And so they have this, like, very specific lens and very specific biases that they're bringing to the coverage. They're asking, how do you protect your breasts during a game? You know, these kinds of things. But on the other hand, I spoke to many players who were like, they made up quotes. They just, like, said things and attributed them to me. And I never said those things. But I wasn't in a place to push back because we needed the coverage so badly.
Yeah, it sounds like the narrative sort of shifts once you start talking to the players themselves, rather than obviously the media coverage, but even hearing from, you know, the Sid Friedmans and some of these male coaches.
Yeah, the women want to talk about the game. They do. And they don't want to be asked if their husband is worried about them getting injured. And again, many of them did not have boyfriends and husbands, and they're having to field these questions about, you know, how those male partners feel about them playing. They don't want to talk about their breasts. If they do, what they want to say is, can you make shoulder pads that fit our bodies? Because the ones that we're wearing are made for children, like small boys or men, and they're hurting us. Because they really did. They, like, the women would take, like, knee pads and, like, cut them up, and, like, they made breast pads for themselves. But the media really was interested in the spectacle of the whole thing. And once it was no longer a novelty, once they didn't like the product on the football field, once they couldn't come gawk anymore, you see media coverage really, really dwindle and pretty much disappear.
And does that track along with kind of the ultimate fizzling out of the league?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we think about, at its height, some of these teams are drawing, I'd say, like 4,000 people to a game. You know, the Dallas team is playing in the same stadium as the Dallas Cowboys. And so 4,000 people for the teams that are playing at, like, you know, in high school fields is a really pretty packed, very packed crowd. 4,000 people in the stadium the Cowboys play in feels very empty, but in terms of the standard trajectory of a sports league, actually 4,000 fans in your first year is incredibly good.
Did you have, or do you have any favorites of these teams or even team rivalries?
I do. So, on, like, a personal level, I'm partial to the Blue Bonnets, mostly because at the time that I started talking to them, they ended up inspiring me to leave my straight marriage and, like, come out. And so they were very supportive of me during that process. And so I'm, like, very partial to them. And, like, you know, I loved reporting their story. But if we're going to talk like from a football perspective, I think there's a few things that stand out to me. The Troopers, who we've talked about being like the winningest team of all time, their biggest rivals were the Detroit Demons. And I love this rivalry because the Demons were terrible. I don't think the Demons ever beat the Troopers, not once ever in like many seasons. But these two teams just absolutely hated each other. I just love that. Your biggest rivalry is a team that like just isn't a threat to you at all. I love that. And I think, you know, the other one also is the Oklahoma City Dolls, who were the first team to beat the Troopers, and they did it in their first season. And the Troopers had been undefeated for, I want to say, six seasons up until that point. And I love that a new team came in and beat them and ended up giving them a really iconic championship game that is still disputed to this day.
Do you have any MVPs?
Linda Jefferson, every player you talk to, no matter what team they were on, talked about Linda Jefferson. And like, Linda Jefferson was star halfback for the Toledo Troopers, and she was on the cover of magazines, and she was on TV, and her stats are wild. I think she retired with like more touchdowns than Walter Payton, Jim Brown, and OJ Simpson. Watching her, watching old footage of her, oh my gosh, like you have to hand it to Linda Jefferson. So like from a football standpoint, I think she really is the best in that league and one of the best of all time. And the other person that I'll shout out is Rose Lowe, who was the quarterback of the Los Angeles Dandelions. And if you see our book, she's in the center with the headphones on her head. And she was incredible because she was really nervous to talk to us. And this book would not exist without her.
Why do you think she was so nervous?
Most of the women we spoke to described being in this league as the best years of their lives, even if they only played one season. You know, it was like the best time in their whole life. And, you know, they got to fulfill a childhood dream. They were like a pro football player. It's a big deal. And I think it was very dear to Rose, and she didn't want the story to be exploited. She didn't want it to be another gimmick. She wanted to make sure that whoever told the story was going to do it justice. And she really wanted it told the right way. And so, yeah, she was really nervous to talk. Most of the women, when we called them up, were like, where have you been? We've been waiting 50 years for someone to ask us about this.
Right.
You know, most of them were really, really happy to do this. One of the Columbus Pacesetters players, Linda Stamps, I connected with her after the book was done. And most of what she told me isn't in the book, but it did run at Sports Illustrated as a digital cover story on the day we published. And it was, you know, a story about the Pacesetters. She called me that day and was like, my childhood dream was to be a professional football player. And today I'm on the cover of Sports Illustrated as a football player. And like, you made my childhood dream come true. And I was just like, oh my God. I was like a mess. I was like sobbing. But they've waited their whole lives for someone to ask them about this.
Yeah. Well, how do you see the legacy of this league?
I believe that this league belongs in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And Lindsay and I, that is when we are asked about the league and what we hope will happen. There's a lot of things we hope will happen, right? Like, I want to see a movie or a TV show or something like that. But really what I want is for these women to be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. I think that like that ultimately is what they deserve.
Thank you so much to Frankie De La Cretaz and to Lindsay D'Arcangelo for co-authoring Hail Mary, The Rise and Fall of the National Women's Football League. You can also subscribe to Frankie's excellent queer sports and pop culture Substack, Out of Their League. And hey, if you want to toss a Hail Mary my way, come on and join the Unladies Room Patreon. It is an incredibly meaningful way to support this show, an independent feminist podcast, for $5 a month. Patreon.com/unladylikemedia or search Unladylike Media in your Patreon app to join. You can also follow Unladylike for free on social media. At Unladylike Media on Instagram and TikTok. I would also, as always, love to hear from you. If you have any football stories or if there are sports stories you'd like to hear, anything like that, hello@unladylike.co is where you can email me, or better yet, send me a voice memo. Or you can DM me voice memos on Instagram. Again, that is at Unladylike Media. Unladylike is an Unladylike Media production, executive produced, written, hosted, and edited by me, Kristen Conger. Engineering is by Amita Ganatra. Our music is by Flamingo Shadow, Amit May Cohen, and Sarah Tudson. Until next week, what is the most unladylike thing about you?
That I'm not a lady. that I gave it up.
Perfect.